The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea win the Champions League for the second time. The movement of Havertz, Mount slide rule pass, the insane energy of Kante, the curious Timo Werner and the brutal shoulder of Rudiger. Tuchel beats Pep again. So many questions. Or more accurately, one question. Why did Pep do that? Fernandinho or Rodri, one of them is fine. And when it isn't working, why not change it back? Our fine panel will try and explain it all and hopefully give Thomas Tuchel some credit just at the end. Also today, Brentford are in the Premier League. What a devastating weekend for QPR and Fulham fans. Ivan Toney leads the Bees to the Big Honey as they comfortably defeat Swansea. Triumph for Blackpool in the League One playoffs. A great victory for fans who've been through much. Also, the England squad have arrived together. They don't look tired. There really is a managerial merry-go-round to think about. There's your questions and another worrying kitchen pod-based injury to apologise for. All on today's Guardian Football Week. Danny says, would doing a pod without Barry Glendening be like playing a Champions League final without a holding midfielder and cause the whole thing to go tits up? Barry, welcome.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
The rock that is needed for the others to flourish around you. Barney Ronay, hello.
Hello. How are you? I was thinking it was more the other way. I think Barry's the fun stuff. You know, if you played five Barrys, the pod would fall apart.
Do you think so? Johnny Liu joins us as well. Hey, Johnny.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks very much. So, Manchester City 0, Chelsea 1. Barney, Johnny, you were both there. Barney, how was it?
It was kind of amazing. I wonder if it had any effect on the players, but I certainly felt a bit weird being in that stadium. It's an amazing stadium. It's really beautiful. I really like it, the stadium there. It's really open. The sun comes in. There's a really lovely climate and there's so much light and space and all these people. And it reminded me of that bit in Apocalypse Now where they're talking about Mr. Clean on the boat and he's out there, he's come from Brooklyn and he says the light and space of Nam really put the zap on his head. And I really felt like it put the zap on my... And I wondered if it had any effect on the players. I mean, they haven't played in that atmosphere for a while, I suppose. And I thought in the first 5 minutes, there was this sort of incredible thing when you saw Guardiola's team sheet and everybody was kind of, you know, what's this? He's playing all jam and no bread. And I was really into it. I thought he's not overthought this. This is going to work because these are brilliant players. He knows what he's doing. It's going to be brilliant. And in the first 5 minutes, there was this amazing fluidity. They actually played really well, I thought, for 5 minutes. And Zinchenko was running inside and everyone was everywhere. Foden was in four different positions. And then you could visibly see them becoming tired and confused because it asks so much of your concentration to play like that, where you don't have a starting position, where you're constantly thinking about where you should be. And you could see the players becoming tired and confused by it, the concentration required after that adrenal burst at the beginning. And I think after about 10 minutes, I said to Jacob Steinberg, he's got this wrong. This isn't going to work. Obviously, I'm repeating this now because they didn't go on to win 4-0. But yeah, like you say, there was no change until the hour mark when De Bruyne went off.
Johnny, how did you enjoy the game? And the atmosphere as well.
I thought it was a really great game. I mean, it was just like so many levels better than Liverpool Spurs a couple of years ago. Possibly even as good as last year's final, which I thought was another cracker. I thought having fans, you know, and having particularly that number of fans, which is a slightly different noise. They made a good noise, but it was a slightly different noise to a packed stadium. It did feel slightly weird for about 20, 30 minutes. And that's why I think like that opening, which was really good and really fun and really fast, It was kind of unsustainable, and it was a product of this whole weirdness. You know, you've been sort of, you maybe haven't seen your team for, you know, 12, 15 months, and not only are you now seeing them, you're seeing them in Porto in bright sunshine in a Champions League final. There was really kind of a almost like a gap year feel to it. And then, you know, the sun goes down and, you know, both teams sort of knuckle down and it was kind of a totally different game after about half an hour. A much more serious game, and still like this incredibly taut, thrilling spectacle right to the end, where you think, you know, City are as bad as they've played, as badly as they've got this wrong. You still, but part of you thinks they're going to, you know, they're City. They're going to burgle something here. They're going to score, And you know that chance for I think with Mahrez right at the end, like just like absolutely gripping, thrilling drama. But the right result, I think.
Dermot says, is Pep actually trying to prove a point, or did he think that was his best 11? And that's the thing, I can't work it out. We all know Pep knows more about football than all of us put together. But it seems such an odd selection. Barry?
Yeah, he has been getting a lot of criticism for not playing a holding midfielder, or not playing a specialist holding midfielder. He did play a holding midfielder, but just one who should have been probably further up the pitch. He has lost twice against Chelsea before this season. It was once with Rodri, I think, and then once with Rodri and Fernandinho. So there's no guarantee that City would have won if he had played one or both of them. But he seems to have, you know, tied one arm behind his back before a ball had been kicked in the game. And I think that's what I find quite puzzling. I mean, I think Chelsea deserve tremendous credit because every single one of their players was outstanding. I mean, the only one you could point to possibly not having a great game is Edouard Mendy. That's because he wasn't really called upon to do much.
Barney, you were shaking your head.
Well, I was just thinking, I've seen this idea put out there that the City had lost twice to Chelsea recently, so they had to do something. You know, what could they do? They had to change.
That's not what I said.
Which Barry obviously just said. And I was shocked to hear him saying exactly those words. But I have seen that said, a version of what you just said.
But that's literally not what I said.
Well, what you said was they lost with Fernandinho and Rodri in the team. You said, so he had to, you know, it's understandable he might have tried something else.
No, I said the first bit. I didn't say the second bit.
You said there was no guarantees.
This is like Pep making the final about himself. Barry is making my point all about him now. let's give praise to my point, you know, like Tuchel's Chelsea as well as Barry's. But anyway, what I was trying to say is it made less sense because of those defeats, because what happened there was Chelsea just kept having joy in this one particular channel where Werner would sort of linger and they played this quite simple pass over the top, and he just kept getting into these difficult spaces they couldn't deal with because they didn't have, the defensive line was really high and they weren't covering these attacks. So the idea that the answer to that was to simply have no defensive shield, it wasn't a logical response to those defeats. Which also had quite funky selections and were not the first team. They hadn't played the first team, which was pointing you towards playing the team you normally play, not a strange, brittle version of that.
And Johnny, it wasn't working, and it's good to try new things, but we all could see it wasn't working certainly by half time. You know, how much criticism should Pep get for not changing it until the hour mark?
To expect him to just sort of hold his hands up after half an hour and go like, nah, you know what? This kind of master plan that I prepared for the Champions League final, not working. I'm not sure that's really... I mean, it's not in his character, but it's also not really what you want from Pep. If you're going to, you know, if you are going to commit to this like incredibly experimental kamikaze lineup in a Champions League final, you kind of want him to see it through to the end. And, you know, we could see it wasn't working, but also there is a kind of hindsight there in that, you know, like I was saying, as badly as they played, they were still plenty of pressure towards the end. You know, they could have fluked a penalty. You know, Mahrez could have fluked that that shot in near the end.
Yeah, but they're better than that, aren't they?
They are better than that.
Demonstrably been brilliant playing with one of those players.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened is he was influenced by particularly the cup semi-final. And I think he kind of underestimated Chelsea. You saw in the days before when Guardiola talked about what he liked about Tuchel's Chelsea, he always said they're really compact, they're really tight, they play close together, the defenders play close to each other, the midfielders play close to the defence. He was really kind of expecting them to play really, you know, like in a tight shell, and that City would dominate possession and that the main crux of the game would be, could City break, find a way through that shell? And I think that kind of, he sort of underestimated Chelsea, who are let's not forget, really good and have some amazing players going forward. And I think he misread the game. He totally kind of misjudged what sort of game it was going to be. Where City, yeah, they did have more possession, but Chelsea had more than one way of getting out, of breaking the press. They could play it into the channels. They could play it out through the wing backs. And they can, you know, they even managed to play it through the centre when Kante got hold of the ball and went on one of his little gallops. So I think that was kind of that was the main error by Guardiola. He foresaw a game that Chelsea were actually better than, you know, they were better than that, than what he thought they were.
Barney, you've written a piece about N'Golo Kante, and he's been consistently sensational throughout the knockout stages of this competition.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about Kante is how I think he's been really key to how well they've done against Man City in that game. He's like, it always surprises me about the false nine system that people are still really confused by. Like, oh my God, he's playing a false nine. Like, what are we going to do? I've got no one to mark. You know, as though we're so rigid in the way we think about defending that people are going to be utterly baffled by the idea there's no man to sort of grab constantly. And the idea is your centre-backs will follow this deeper centre-forward and your wide players can run into the spaces behind. And it does seem to baffle teams still. But the thing about Kante is he's perfectly designed to counteract that. He is also interested in those same spaces and he follows those runs and he's looking for it to happen. And he seems to be one of the players with the sort of tactical knowledge and instinct, I suppose, to really counteract that kind of movement. So he's perfect for City and their baffling false nine system. And he was brilliant. Even though they played a lot in Chelsea's house, like Johnny was saying, you didn't feel they were really under pressure, Chelsea, because when Kante gets the ball, he's so good at releasing the pressure. He either says, right, I'm going to carry it up the field because everyone needs to get set again behind me, or I'm going to pass it quickly. And he makes really good decisions in those little areas there. He was sensational.
I think that's a very harsh criticism of Kante, Barney, saying he had a bad game. I thought he was quite impressive.
Yeah, he's just a runner, isn't he?
Is he kind of a... seems to be a footballer like no other, or sort of the ultimate version of that kind of footballer, Johnny? Because he's so much more than, you know, talking about City playing a holding midfielder, but he's so much more than that.
Yeah, I mean the comparison I think early in his time in English football was with Makalele, who I think was a genuine, you know, holding midfielder. His job was basically to sit there and distribute. And we think of playmakers, we think of kind of creative, flamboyant attacking midfielders, you know, spraying 50, 60 yard passes, you know. But Kante is a kind of playmaker. You know, it all runs through him. And you know, whether or not he's moving the ball upfield or whether he's laying it off or whether he's breaking up play, he is kind of the heart of everything they do. And Chelsea look like a worse or certainly less sophisticated team when he's not involved. And I think maybe it was Barney made this point in a year or two ago that for a long time, the thing that we used to say about Kante was that he was the kind of player that allows other players to play around him. You know, you think like Pogba and Matuidi with France or Mahrez with Leicester, right? But he is the kind of the player that everything is based around now. Like, he's not kind of the less talented sort of lumpen midfielder who allows more talented players to play around him. He's the talent. And I think people are kind of slowly coming around to that now.
His hard work enables himself to play. He's that good that he does the work for himself.
Well, he does, you know, because you see him, like, he's not only just in front of the defence, you know, like those kind of false nine spaces, but he's also, often, he's one of the highest players up the field pressing. So he's winning the ball high up the field so he can then use it. And then he's back in front of his defence, winning the ball, so he can then just take it forward to himself further up the field. You know, he's really quite paradoxical.
Do we think he's an incredibly arrogant, selfish player? Kante just playing for himself, constantly making his own job easier. Who is this egomaniac?
He actually, you sort of uniquely among elite level footballer. He doesn't appear to have any ego whatsoever. Maybe it's all just front, and he is a raving megalomaniac, egomaniac. Interestingly, he actually won more aerial duels in that game than any other player, which seems quite remarkable given the fact that he's 18 inches tall.
I bumped into him once at a do, and he was so much shorter than me. My instant reaction was, he can't be better than me at football, but all the evidence in front of us suggests he is. Barney.
Well, I was going to say, the other interesting thing I noticed about him is he hasn't been sent off in English football. He's only been sent off once in his whole life when he was playing for Caen 6 years ago. He got two yellows and probably felt terrible about it for ages. And it seems impossible that that can be true, given that he is constantly in areas of collision. But it shows how smart he is, that he gets booked, but he won't be sent off. He can moderate what he does so cleverly and how aware he is of things.
I think he got taken off in the World Cup final after about sort of 55 minutes or something, because he was sort of in danger of getting sent off. I think he got an early yellow.
Well, he was ill. He was ill. Wasn't he?
He also had dysentery or something.
I ran the marathon with dysentery. I wouldn't recommend it. It was quite hard. No.
Are you looking for sympathy?
No, I was looking for some.
Little
normally,
hero.
In previous tellings of I ran the marathon with dysentery, there's been more than just absolute silence, but that's fine.
But no, you constantly, every Sunday, on Marathon Sunday, every year without fail, you tell how you ran the marathon twice and it was horrible. I don't think I've ever heard that you ran it with dysentery before.
Yeah, I got dysentery in Goa.
It's not a classic act of heroism, really. I mean, I think that maybe that's why, you know, I ran the marathon, you know, with you know, one leg with a knee, my knee in a brace, you know, oh wow, that's great. Oh, I ran the marathon with cerebral palsy, you know, that's a classic act of heroism. I ran the marathon with dysentery. That's kind of, ooh, don't know if you should have been doing that.
I ran the marathon to warn about the Greek ships and then immediately died. That's heroic.
Yes.
You're right. Can we talk about Kai Havertz, please? I got yelled at by some Manchester United fans specifically for saying he's a sort of left-footed Berbatov, but he reminds me so much of him, and actually possibly with, you know, it's too early to say, but with a bit more because he's slightly quicker. I thought he was glorious in that game, Johnny.
Yeah, I saw the Berbatov comparisons. I do see it. You know, they're kind of similar statures, and he's got this lovely sort of double touch where he brings the ball under control and then kind of knocks it to one side, which is with the same foot often, which is what Berbatov did. But they are completely different players as well. I mean, Havertz is kind of an all action. You know, once he gets galloping. You know, you saw him sort of haring through that gap that Zinchenko and Diaz left him, and you know, nobody was catching him. There was a real assurance from the moment he took possession of that ball, and I know it sort of bobbled off Edison a bit, but you know, how many times have we seen, I don't know, to pick a name at random, Raheem Sterling mess up one of those chances? There was a kind of nervelessness there, which I think was really impressive for somebody who's 21 playing his, I think, first major final. He was fantastic. I mean, Chelsea had great performances all over the pitch, but I thought Havertz, especially given the fact that it was quite a contentious selection. You know, you could have made a case for playing Ziyech there or Pulisic. You know, he had a lot to prove, and he hasn't had the greatest season. He's spent a lot of this season with Chelsea trying to discover his best role. And, you know, I think he proved quite a few people wrong.
His post-match interview on BT Sport was also a thing of great beauty, where he effed and jeffed at Des Kelly.
It seemed the perfect time to do it, didn't it, really? Does Gareth Southgate need to just let all the other fullbacks go home now, given how well Chilwell and Reece James played in this game?
Well, there was a talk that Reece James might be, you know, in trouble for his place a bit, but I think that would be a bit weird now. I mean, he was really good, I thought, and he's a really good one-on-one defender. I think people have said that he gets caught positionally once or twice, but he's really good at recovering, and he's only 21, so that is something he can work on. You'd think they have to. You'd think they've got to be up there, wouldn't you? And I think Chilwell's really good, and he's probably sort of modern attacking fullback. I think maybe Luke Shaw can be a little bit more solid in some senses. I don't mean that literally, Luke. But Chilwell kind of gets up and down really well. It'd be hard not to pick them after playing like that.
So I actually think Chilwell's touch was really important for the goal, because it, even though Mount did have too much time, it enabled Mount to have that much time, I thought, because it was such a clever, and it was such a sort of, it was a lovely touch and not a simple thing to do.
Gareth Southgate would be justified in selecting them, of course, but is there a bit of recency bias there? It's just because that's the last game we saw and they were both really good.
But football is recency. It's what's happening right now. You could say that after a goal or a victory, there's a recency bias in Chelsea beating Man City in the final of the Champions League. That's what's happened now. But you're just looking at the last game. Who says they're champions of Europe? And I don't know. I mean, it seems like if you play really well in a major European final just before a tournament squad is selected, you'd be justified in saying the last thing that happened is relevant.
They always used to, when England picked cricket squads to tour in the winter, they always used to wait until after the NatWest Trophy final. And it was always said that a good performance in the NatWest Trophy final, a 60-over game, could get you a place on a three-month England test tour in completely different circumstances. There's a little bit of that. I mean, I thought James had a... I thought he had a fine game. I thought he started really quite nervously. City pressed him quite successfully. He didn't look that assured on the ball. He did settle in the game, and I think he found it a lot more comfortable when it was kind of a, you know, when Chelsea got the lead and it was a slightly more it was a slightly simpler game, you know, where Chelsea had their back to the wall a little bit. I think if you're not going to pick Trent Alexander-Arnold because he occasionally gets called out of position and has to recover, then you can't pick Reece James on the same basis. That said, I think they're both fantastic, and I think Kieran Trippier and Kyle Walker should both go as well. Why not just pick all of the good players and see what you can do with them?
I think what Barry was saying was that, like you say, Trent Alexander-Arnold was the best fullback in the world for a year. He was brilliant, but I think it's more that hadn't played that well for England, whereas James has. And there was that weird thing of Gareth Southgate saying, it's my fault. I haven't got the most out of him. I need to look at myself, after he dropped not himself, but Trent Alexander-Arnold as a result of that. And it just doesn't seem to fit into the England system for some reason. But I think he's much, in a way, much more talented than Reece James. I mean, he can do incredible things with the ball, which I haven't seen Reece James doing. But James has just looked very good whenever he's played for England, very settled.
Theron says, should all players wear protective face masks just in case Tony Rudiger decides to lodge his shoulder in their orbital socket? I mean, it was interesting. When that challenge happened, I instantly thought, well, that's just a yellow card. And the extent of the injury shouldn't necessarily define what card you get. But I wonder if that should be a red card. And I wonder if the way that we watch that kind of intentional block and we regard it should change, because players get sent off for causing damage when they're out of control. But Rudiger was completely in control. In many ways, that seems a worse crime, Barry.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think you wouldn't think that if De Bruyne hadn't suffered two fractures to his face. And I do feel sorry for him, because I suspect he's going to miss the Euros, because those orbital socket injuries are very serious and I don't think a mask will cut it. So if that's the case, that's a tragedy for him and for Belgium, I suppose. But I get your point, but I think you're only making it because De Bruyne got injured, and most times he wouldn't have suffered those fractures. You know, it happens all the time in football. And
is it recency bias from me?
No, I just think it's injury-related bias.
Johnny?
It's victim justice. That's what it is. I mean, no, I you do feel for De Bruyne there, but, you know, without wishing to be too kind of callous about it, football is kind of a, you know, it's a collision, it's a contact sport. You know, I think it's kind of on a register with, same register as a clash of heads, which, you know, is often horrific when you see it happening, and can generate some quite spine-chilling injuries. But it's hard to see how you can possibly legislate against a clash of heads if you are prepared to have a football in the air and people heading it, people trying to head it. It's one of those, I think. You know, it's
sure,
a collision.
But that's interesting, because if I kick the ball and then you come at you are going for the ball with your foot and you take me late, that is a yellow or a red card. But if I head the ball and then you come at me with your head late, it's still a late challenge. It's just a different part of your body. I totally agree with sort of how I've always viewed the game. I just wonder, and maybe it is totally, you know, victim justice. What are you laughing at, Barney?
I'm just wondering how you would stop. You're flying through the air, but the ball has gone, and you have to somehow pause yourself in midair.
You have to time a challenge, don't you? If you mistime a challenge, it's a foul.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. When you're challenging for a header, it takes you what? How long does it take you to think, I'm going to challenge for this header, to go through the kind of physical thing of leaping? It's a lot more of a protracted, sort of extended physical process than trying to kick the ball.
Yeah, it's like when airlines say, like, oh, you know, your safety is our number one priority. I mean, it's clearly not. Otherwise, you wouldn't, you know, you just would just stay there. You would just stay on the ground. there comes a point where a certain quantum of risk has to be incorporated into the game. And the laws are, you know, are extremely woolly on stuff like this. I think the law is, if you endanger an opponent, you know, if you make a tackle that endangers an opponent, well, any kind of, you know, any challenge where you're flinging your head in the general direction of another human being is, you know, there's going to be an element of danger to that. So I think there has to be a kind of a modicum of common sense applied there.
Thomas says, does Barney have any more Radiohead-themed articles in the pipeline? Perhaps a No Surprises article ready for when France win the Euros, or Creep as Daniel Levy lusts after Poch?
Someone suggested the words are coming out all wrong would be a good line to add into my next attempt to use the English language. It seemed to be an appropriate line for my 90s-based kind of dad rock cultural references. Just perfectly hit the spot.
If somebody was to go through all your columns of all time, would they all have nights, you know, is there some REM in your early work? Is there some Carter, the unstoppable sex machine?
Yeah, as I develop, yeah. As my tastes have developed and moved with the times, yeah. Probably. Yeah, probably. Okay. I do like to put like the odd song lyric in. It's kind of a fun game. And also, lines from Philip Larkin.
Connor says, how was the theatre? And Mark, who is the Daily Mirror showbiz editor, says, how was the theatre, Max? If I'd known Pep was going to leave out Fernandinho and Rodri from our lineup, I might have joined you. Thank you very much for those important questions. It was the Harry Hill's Tony Blair rock opera, of which they showed us part one, reading from scripts. It was all very sort of early and it was quite fun. I enjoyed it tremendously. And Charlie Baker as Tony Blair was excellent.
We haven't praised Thomas Tuchel yet, have we? We haven't actually talked about Chelsea. We're obsessed with Pep. Oh my God, he's living rent-free in all our heads.
Come on then, let's do 2 minutes of Tuchel and then we'll get on to Brentford.
Well, I mean, obviously they were really good. I mean, it's an incredible thing, isn't it? They're champion. We were talking about this before. We're saying with the whole thing about the City thing is if they win, it's this project realised. You know, it's this incredible feat of organisation and money spent, but also every layer of the club's been it's all been geared towards this thing. It's this narrative is complete. But Chelsea winning is kind of, it's sort of meaningless. Like the empty universe, you know, there is no God. There's no meaning here. You can just do a few things and then you win. Manager sort of managing on the hoof, doing a brilliant job. Because I don't feel like there's a team there. He's going to have to start building the team now. He's done a brilliant thing with a really strong group of players, but he'll be thinking, right, how do I turn this into a team now? You know, how do I start making these people play my way? Because he doesn't, I think, want to just be this very defensively, brilliantly stitched manager. I think he wants to play a different kind of game to that. But what he's done in the last 5 months is extraordinary. And it's it just shows the difference between a really, really brilliant coach who can react to an opponent and to things that happen in a game and those who are not quite at that level. I think it's a real career-defining moment for Tuchel, personally.
Johnny?
Champions League is a really stupid competition when you think about it. I mean, City are the best team in Europe, and we all kind of know this, and they've been the best team in Europe for like the last 3 or 4 years. They're just like a rogue cop. He just can't prove it. He knows who did it. He just can't prove it. And I think that's the kind of the glory and the caprice of the Champions League that Tuchel comes in, inherits what is basically like a dysfunctional team from Frank Lampard, and wins four knockout ties and claims the biggest prize in the club game. It's brilliant. I mean, it's there is no sense to it.
Would it make more sense if there was some kind of league for these sides?
Yeah, like a sort of a round robin. But you know, even the Super League, you know, had it culminated in quarterfinals, semifinals, and a final. And you know, while you have the same teams there every year, there's still, you know, as long as you have like, you know, 90 minutes to decide everything, there is always going to be an element of what if there.
But having said all that, they have beaten the champion. Chelsea have beaten the champions of Spain. They've been Real Madrid, the Aristos of Europe, and now the champions of England and the best team. So despite somehow not being the best team in Europe and losing to Aston Villa and West Brom, they've still proved themselves to be the best team in Europe on any reasonable register. It's very odd. I suppose they didn't beat Bayern Munich or PSG, but they beat the man who beat the man who beat the man.
Well, there is that stat doing the round where, you know, Tuchel in 9 games against the managerial bigwigs this season has won 9 out of 9.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Brentford in the Premier League. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We've got a live show, Barry, June the 10th, Thursday nights before the Euros begin. Get your tickets from theguardian.com/guardianlive. I've been informed, Barry, that we've made like a musical montage for the beginning and some extra musical-based things. So there's a reason to come along, isn't there?
Well, I'm already intrigued because I wasn't aware of this.
So that means you'll definitely turn up.
I will be there.
Okay, Lars Sivertsen, Jonathan Wilson with us, theguardian.com/guardianlive. You have to scroll down a bit. We're on the right, or you might accidentally go to something important and political instead. But, you know,
with Marina Hyde and John Crace.
Yes, but I mean, look, that would also be good. So we'd recommend that. You might learn something from that.
Brentford, also a musical interlude.
Yes, I hope so. Brentford 2, Swansea 0. Brentford into the top flight for the first time since 1946, 47. It's worth £178 million, this game. The 50th different team to join the Premier League, the 10th side from London to do it. And Barry, they completely deserved it, didn't they?
Yeah, they were more than worthy winners, dominated from start to finish, with the exception perhaps of a brief period after the half-time when Swansea looked quite threatening. Only for Jay Fulton to get sent off, and that kind of ruined their any chance they had. This was, you know, we were talking about should Rudiger have got a red card. This was a bit of a funny one as well. At first, it looked like a really reckless challenge, in keeping with quite a few reckless challenges from a very aggressive Swansea side, who were jumping into tackles all over the place and. I think Matt Grimes, their captain, could consider himself very lucky not to have been sent off quite early for a bad tackle. But he did get booked, and that he was clearly conscious of the fact that he was on a yellow for whatever it was, 90 or 85 minutes, and that definitely affected his performance in midfield. Brentford were, you know, they weren't troubled unduly, and they won as I think most people expected them to.
That red card was odd because it was Jay Fulton on Matthias Jensen, and he was sort of just carried on running and Jensen came across him, but he managed to put his foot on the calf of Jensen and then somehow accelerate up the calf to the point where his feet were sort of almost, you know, it was extraordinary. It was like there was a travelator on Jensen's calves or something. I couldn't work out how it had happened. It wasn't the main story of the game. I mean, Ivan Toney, looks like a sensational player, and Barney has exceptional confidence as well. You imagine he will be able to break past the Cameron Jerome zone and be a success in the Premier League.
Yeah, I hope so. I remember seeing him play, I think he was at Scunthorpe, wasn't he? He played at the Den, and he really annoyed everyone because he definitely had a bit of a swagger. I think he was on loan from Newcastle and he had this kind of Premier League swagger, and he was good and he was the main threat, but he did fall over quite a lot. And there was loads of kind of, oh God. And then afterwards everyone was like, yeah, he's actually really good, isn't he? Why can't we sign players like that? Like if we had him, he was clearly like a cut above that level. I enjoyed Thomas Frank afterwards said that he's the best penalty taker in the world. And then he qualified that and said he's the best penalty taker in the world by far, not just the best in the world, but by far, which, I mean, obviously he's saying he's really good at taking penalties. But I think he has a really, like you say, a confident air. And it'll be really fascinating to see him in the Premier League. And he's destined to score against Newcastle. That is absolutely going to happen, definitely. He's got that kind of air about him.
And a lot's talked about Brentford's recruitment model. And this is a great example of it, isn't it? Selling Watkins and Benrahma for 60 million, signing Tony for six. And we spoke yesterday, Barry, to their director of football, Rasmus Ankersen. And it was interesting, you know, when we asked him what their plan was, wasn't it?
I can't remember what their plan is.
He just said, buy cheap, sell expensive.
Oh, right. Well, that's their philosophy rather than their plan. But yeah, I mean, they have this reputation for rooting out rough diamonds that other clubs maybe aren't aware of. Although Rasmus did make the point that, you know, other clubs were after Ivan Toney, and he said it's getting these signings over the line and selling Brentford to them, you know, so that they will sign for Brentford rather than Millwall or whoever. That is the most difficult part of the job. So it's not like they have this secret stash of untapped talent that only they are privy to. But they do seem to be, you know, they have a system. It works. They're not going to do a Fulham or a Villa and start splashing out 15, 20, 30 million on players, or spend, you know, 100 million just to try and stay in the Premier League. But maybe they will find the quality of player they're going to need now more difficult to find and sign. And they probably will have to spend a little bit more money. You know, they may find recruitment a little more difficult, but, you know, they have a system that works, and I would imagine they will stick to it. I wouldn't be surprised if they do very well in the Premier League because they're a very good team.
I grew up in Greenford, which is basically like just up the road from Brentford, like on the other end of the E2 bus route. And I suppose they were kind of my local team, although I never really went to see them. And like all the Brentford fans that I knew, they were kind of, it was a little bit like a joke, you know. We used to poke fun at them a little bit, you know, all us who supported, you know, big proper football clubs, you know, because Brentford were, you know, they were never anything. They were sort of the old Division 2 at the time, occasionally Division 1, occasionally Division 3, and just the idea, like from, you know, when I was a kid, that Brentford would now be in the Premier League just seems totally outlandish. It seems ridiculous, and it is kind of ridiculous when you think of, you know, they haven't done it by investing, you know, millions and millions of kind of Chinese investment or American hedge fund money. It's all been done with, you know, smart decisions, good decisions, human decisions. It's kind of an inspiring story, really, that, you know, that they've made a lot of the right decisions, and they've, you know, after many years of kind of knocking at the door, they've finally been rewarded for it.
Yeah, I agree. And another inspiring story is Blackpool, isn't it, to get out of League One into the Championship. They beat Lincoln 2-1. And considering, and we've spoken to, you know, Blackpool fans who were boycotting the club, you know, a couple of years ago, like it's a brilliant story. As Richard says, how good is it to see fans winning against their owners? Barry?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, if Lincoln had won, that would also have been an inspiring story, I suppose. But I enjoyed this game, actually. Blackpool made life difficult for themselves by conceding an own goal after, I think, about 45 seconds, something like that. Oliver Turton. He said after the game, so a cross came in from the right. Tom Hopper tried to steer, you know, into the goal and just couldn't make contact with it. So it comes to Oliver Turton, who's sort of standing in the middle of his six-yard box and seemed to have all the time in the world to do anything but hack the ball into his own goal. But that's what he decided to do anyway. So Blackpool, you know, started with a one-goal handicap, but two goals from Kenneth Dougal, who I presumed would be Scottish. But it turns out he's from Brisbane. So he scored two goals, one with his left, one with his right, otherwise fairly identical shots from outside the area. And I believe, but I could be wrong, that they're only the third and fourth goals he's ever scored. Blackpool deserved to win. And it is nice because their owners were terrible, terrible people. And it took a boycott to get rid of them. And I suppose it just shows that fans do have more power than perhaps they think they do.
Blackpool have won a playoff final for the sixth time in their history. Their last three playoff wins have all been in different divisions. Their new owner, Simon Sadler, is a very popular man and has done great stuff. And Neil Critchley, their manager as well, left Liverpool under 23s in March last year. So it's been quite a turnaround for them. Morecambe Newport is played today. So by the time you hear this, you'll know which one of those two has made it into League One. And we'll talk about that on the next pod. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll talk Euros, the managerial merry-go-round, and any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, I watched a 6-minute video of England players getting out of assorted vehicles near Middlesbrough and being helped with their bags up some steps into what looked like a really nice country manor, which I presume has a golf course on it. And now I feel absolutely supremely confident that England will win the Euros. Gareth Southgate has to let seven people down. Maybe they could just stay in this manor for the month because it did look quite pleasant.
Quite apart from the fact that I'm Irish and therefore ineligible, I could never play for England because I have a pathological, almost psychotic aversion to anyone helping me with my luggage. I just hate it.
A lot of them
respectfully withdraw from the squad if selected.
Well, at that moment, so you're Ben White, you've been driven in a Renault Espace from Brighton to Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
And you get out and then someone picks up your boot bag and that's it. You're like, this was my dream.
I would insist
this has been my whole life. This has been my whole career, but I'm sorry.
No, I would insist on carrying it myself. And if I wasn't allowed, I think the trauma of having another human being carry my luggage would affect me, damage me psychologically so much that I wouldn't be fit to play in the team. I would be a burden.
Anyway, who are the seven, Barney? Or how difficult do you think this is for Southgate? Or do you think he already knows?
I think he probably already knows, but he is having to be quite smart because he obviously didn't know how many players are going to turn up, how many players are going to be injured in the season-ending games this week. So you don't want to send someone away and then have to call them up again because someone else. Oh, by the way, when we said you weren't quite good enough, we've changed our minds. So I think he probably has a good idea. He's pretty into stuff like the sort of things that you slightly scoff at, I certainly slightly scoff at how you get on, how you are around the boys. He's pretty into that stuff. So there may be some element of that. He must know how good these players are. He says he wants to actually see with his own eyes how fit people are. And he said, we need to see them running up and down, he said. Until we've seen them running up and down, we don't know whether they're fit or not. So fair enough, you know, can they run up and down? You can only really judge that with your with your own eyes. But I think it's put him in an awkward position. It's like an awkward sort of social situation where you're not quite sure who's coming to some do you've arranged. And I can't let them down now because I've already invited them. And he's had to kind of just trample over all that and invite everyone and then hope some people drop out. It's like ordering a difficult, probably like having a COVID wedding. You know, you can only have so many people. Are they going to bring their kids? You know, that kind of stuff. But I think he does know who he wants. And once he's picked it, well, as usual, we'll just forget about it and get on with the tournament.
I think a huge amount of it depends on the fitness or lack thereof of Harry Maguire, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's the metatarsal saga of this tournament. I mean, there's been a pleasing lack of hysteria over, you know, things like injuries, but you know, if the Sun were to print a picture of a metatarsal or a foot or a knee, I don't even know what was Maguire injured. It's his knee. You know, it would probably be Maguire because that does seem like England's weak link at the moment. And you know, as much as Ben Godfrey could do a job stepping in or Connor Cody, I think England's defence would lose something if Maguire weren't fit.
It's an interesting randomness to how at any one point, you know, you can have so many incredibly good right backs and not brilliant centre backs, and how that has evolved in presumably complete randomness, not the way that players are coached these days or were coached 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I think Maguire's injury, the point about it is it affects how the team will play. I don't think he has a lot of confidence in many of the other centre backs to play in a back four. Is part of the issue. Whereas Maguire and Stones, I think he'd play a back four, whereas the people who might come in. So it affects things tactically. And he's clearly not quite sure. There seems to be this idea that against better teams, England are going to play a back three, which all comes down to, like, how does Southgate rate you? It's like a kind of swipe left thing. If you play a back four against Croatia, are Croatia going to be really angry? And like, you're what? We're just back four, are we? You know, that's all we are to you. Whereas if he plays a back three, they'll be incredibly respectful and pleased. And it seems like an odd one. But he's opened this up for himself.
I heard our friend Darren Bench, Max, last night. He was chatting on TalkSport, and they were discussing, saying that even if Maguire isn't fit, they should bring him for the knockout stages. It was like thinking, oh, Darren, what have you done? Tempting fate like that. And do you boys never learn?
Wales have picked attacking midfielder Reuben Colwill, 19, only made his Cardiff debut in February. He's only played 6 games, I think, ahead of Tom Lawrence and Rabiu Matondo, amongst others. Gareth Bale, Aaron Ramsey, Joe Allen, Wayne Hennessy, Ben Davis, Johnny Williams, Danny Warden, Chris Gunter, all there from 2016. So they've got those happy memories. No Hal Robson-Kanu, so there'll be no glorious, very slow Cruyff turn in the quarterfinal for Wales this time around. Hey, Johnny, who's going to be the Tottenham manager? Pochettino apparently today is going to tell PSG he doesn't want to stay. He's fed up of working with Mbappe and Neymar, and he wants to work with Eric Lamella again. But Real Madrid might want him too. Interesting position to be in.
Given how quickly Spurs seem to have Mourinho lined up to replace one of the greatest ever managers, it seems kind of remiss of them that they haven't really... I think they wanted Nagelsmann, and that's why they kind of moved really quickly on Mourinho, because they thought they might be able to get Nagelsmann. Nagelsmann went to Bayern. Okay. And then you're left with kind of the same people that always seem to get, you know, linked to the Spurs job. You know, Roberto Martinez, Eddie Howe, you know, whoever's had a good season in the lower half of the Premier League, Eric Ten Hag, Frank de Boer is probably in there somewhere. And out of all this has come this incredible Pochettino rumor. And I mean, I don't personally know how happy he is in Paris, but I mean, what's certainly true is that he's enjoyed a lot less control over the whole organization than he enjoyed at Tottenham. And you know, there's this Bill Bryson line, isn't there? That there are three things you can't do in life. You can't beat the phone company. You can't make a way to see you until he's ready to see you, and you can't go home again. And, you know, there were not many examples of managers going back to their former clubs and making a success of it. But I think emotionally it makes sense, because if Tottenham are talking about returning to the principles that they kind of mislaid under Mourinho, then, you know, what better way of doing that than to go back to the man who essentially established those principles? I think if he wants to go, it's a no-brainer for Tottenham.
The recency bias argument that I made earlier, that Barney rubbished, would suggest he's the wrong choice for Tottenham, because the last time he was managing them, they were doing very badly.
Were they? I thought they did quite well for a while.
They were in the bottom half of the table.
But the thing about recency bias is this is a very modern idea. You're suddenly obsessed with recency bias. It's all you ever talk about. And it is something I've seen mentioned. There's a kind of recency bias towards the idea of recency bias being a thing. I mean, what does that even mean? Like, the thing that was happening recently must be disregarded because of recency. I don't think recency is even a word, is it? Don't you just say recent? Recent bias.
Recency bias is basically like, you know, Andy Murray getting a knighthood, or Angels by Robbie Williams, like winning like the greatest song. Actually, it's not that recent anymore. I've got to show my age there. It's about 25 years old.
that's the most recent song you can think of.
It was named
by Robbie Williams. In many ways, it's a sign that Angels by Robbie Williams has really stood the test of time. And in fact, it's a total argument against.
It was named like the greatest song of all time in about 2001 or something like that. That's what I'm thinking of.
Well, that was because of Princess Diana, wasn't it? That I think that lots of weird things got tied up in Princess Diana. The great thing about Angels by Robbie Williams is that Robbie Williams clearly thinks it's the greatest song anyone's ever written. It's better than, you know, whatever, anything the Beatles ever did. And whenever he sings it, he looks like he's about to die from happiness at how great his song is. Whereas, in fact, it's, appalling.
I don't think he wrote it, Barney, but... And I can confirm that recency is a word.
Actually, Pochettino wasn't doing well at Spurs in that last...
It was 13th. You know,
Barry is right. I hate to back him up, but...
But I mean, before that, you know, in the 5 years before then, they'd done okay, given it's Spurs.
I mean, that's pre-recency bias. Yeah, I think...
Pre-recency bias. Well, I'm arguing against...
We'll see, I guess. Also, rumours that Spurs want Conte. I mean, they can't have both of them, can they? But Conte does seem like an odd fit, given that he likes to spend loads and loads of money. Basically, every team in Italy has changed their manager. Go look up your favourite. Allegri back to Juve, and Inzaghi, Lazio to Inter. Lazio might get Nuno. Spalletti to Napoli. We have Celtic fans who listen, who are worried about Ange Postecoglou coming in, and Australian fans who listen to this pod, who will tell you he's absolutely brilliant manager. And he's, after the Eddie Howe thing fell apart, he is in line to take the job at Parkhead. And he has a very, very good track record, does Postecoglou. And it could be a very interesting appointment. Done incredibly well in Australia, did well with the Socceroos, did well in Japan. And so it may not work.
I have seen some Celtic fans arguing that doing well in Japan doesn't count because it's a Mickey Mouse league. I mean, the irony is just delicious there. But I'm not sure how big a manager they think they can attract. But there's a major rebuild needed at Celtic. And whoever does get the job, will have a huge challenge ahead.
I will. Barney, you were in a BBC documentary about Cristiano Ronaldo, impossible to ignore. I don't know if anyone's seen it, but there were some lovely shots of your garden, Barney, and you're filmed from maybe even three angles. That's a great opportunity to see all parts of your head.
Don't watch it. Don't watch the bits I'm... I didn't realise that was going to happen. I agreed to do it. They were really nice, these nice guys. And then suddenly my son said, you're on this weird TikTok with Rio Ferdinand. And there actually are pictures of me sitting there. I didn't know they were going to turn up. They suddenly turned up. I'm wearing one of my children's tops. That's not mine. It's as though they've all had makeup and they're all ready for this. And they've thought about what to say. I think I'd be in it. And there I am going, oh, he's just a pure winner. You know, Ronaldo, all he does is win, you know, as though I've really thought about this and I wanted to be in it. And I'm putting myself up against Alan Shearer as the great arbiter of what Cristiano Ronaldo means. But I'm sure it's a good documentary.
Hmm. Don't put yourself down, Barney. You came across with great authority.
Was Alan Shearer in your garden?
Yeah, Alan Shearer was in his garden, covered in makeup. And Barney was just there in a gilet going, what's happening here? Strange situation to be in. Here's an email from Valentino. Dear Max and Barry and everyone else, I've been a huge fan of the pod since 2016 when I discovered it during the Euros. As a Croatian, my favourite moment was Barry's jubilation after the 2018 Croatia-England semi-final. Before COVID, I used to listen to the pod on my commute. These days, I usually listen to it while cooking or playing as Brentford in FIFA career mode. I do not have a car crash story, but I did sustain a cooking injury while listening to the pod. Last September, I moved from the US to Edinburgh for 3 months to start my PhD in politics. During my second day of the quarantine, I was listening to the pod and preparing chicken saltimbocca when a kitchen knife slipped and sliced the top of my left hand index finger right off. I remember panicking and trying to contain the bleeding while Barry's soothing voice was complaining about something in the background. I ended up at a minor injuries clinic, and after a couple of stitches and a few weeks of recovery, I'm able to use the finger again. I would like to give a shout out to my mother-in-law, Susan, who is also a fan of the pod and a trained nurse who reassured me that my finger will eventually heal. She's a Spurs fan, so after this season, I feel she could use a shout out from one of her favourite podcasts. Keep up the good work. I'm looking forward to your coverage of the Euros. Best wishes, Valentino. Well, best wishes from us to you and your missing finger. And it seems like a perfect way to end the podcast today, unless anyone else has anything of note they'd like to add. No? Marvellous. thank you, Barry.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Barney.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Thank you, Johnny.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.